is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And we appreciate everybody taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you're with that esteemed cohort that are listening to us live, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room. If you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there's a question that you would like for us to direct to our guest, that's the perfect place to put it because we'll be watching it during the course of the show. And if you got to take off and watch the Tar Heels probably lose in a few minutes here and you want to check up on what you missed, feel free to go over and get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or in your sorrows, you can head on over to iTunes or Stitcher and just subscribe to it and listen to it at your leisure. But hey, let's go ahead and dive into the show. Always things like this I find very exciting. And if you're a navalist or you're somebody who enjoys history, I think you're really going to enjoy today's show, not just because we got some regular guests that are always a pleasure to have on board, but also it's a fun topic. Put your shoes in the foot of a museum curator. You've managed to scrape up some money to do some needed preservation work on some captured battle flags that we took from the British, and if you want to call them the Canadians, during the War of 1812. And in the course of doing that, like some sequel to National Treasure, you find something you didn't really expect to be there. It's a very exciting accidental archaeology that didn't require anybody to go to dangerous countries or get malaria or get shot at. And it all took place at what really is the beating heart of the U.S. Navy, the Naval Academy over at Annapolis. And today we brought on two gentlemen that everybody who are regulars at Midrats are very familiar with to talk about a little bit of time travel and some reminders of some lesser known but very important part of our naval heritage that still resonates today. And our guests are going to be Commander B.J. Armstrong, United States Navy, Claude Berrabay, who's a lieutenant commander in the United States Naval Reserve. But Claude probably is going to speak to us today as the director of the Naval Academy Museum. And what's also neat about this topic is it touches on the fringes and maybe a couple inches deep into some of the areas that he studied. And he just finished up his doctoral dissertation on Andrew Jackson's Navy over the University of Leeds. And also, B.J. Armstrong, not only does he teach history at the U.S. Naval Academy, he has a Ph.D. in war studies from the old country at King's College in London. B.J. and Claude, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, guys. Pleasure to be here.
And let's just go ahead and dive into a scene setter that I touched on a little bit in the intro. And Claude, let me go ahead and roll this to you. Because what started this whole chain of events is we have some captured battle flags from the War of 1812 that have been at the Naval Academy for a while. And like many historical objects that are made out of biodegradable material, they need regular preservation work. I figured, start for a bit, let's talk about what was the initiating point to finding these other objects. And that was the captured battle flags that we took from the British during the War of 1812. And maybe talk for a little bit as well about the preservation team that got to work on them.
Okay. So to set the scene, Mahan Hall is one of the oldest buildings at the United States Naval Academy. It was built at the turn of the century. And when it was built, these what are called trophy flags from the War of 1812 and other flags were hung in Mahan Hall itself. Some of them were put in these alcoves in the lobby. We have five large alcoves. And there they were sealed up behind glass for more than 100 years. Well, why do we have them? You have to go back to the War of 1812, because during that war, we began capturing flags like from the Guerriere, the Java, Cyane, Levant that we would later display. And Congress legislated $500 for the preservation of flags captured in combat. So I think it was very important that even early on in our history, we recognize the preservation of national naval heritage from any country. Fast forward to President James Knox Polk, who, once the United States Naval Academy is established, decides by executive order that all flags captured by U.S. naval forces will go to the Naval Academy. In 1912, an officer at the Academy decides that, hey, these flags are really in bad condition. They're just hanging up in the hall itself with hundreds of midshipmen. We're going to put them behind the glass. And Congress, he actually launches an advocacy effort, if you will, because the Navy bureaucracy was not supportive of this. So we have letters of him reaching out to all these patriotic naval organizations saying, write to your member of Congress, help us preserve these flags. They appropriate $35K, which is about $850,000 today, to display these in the cases. So there we have the setup for why they were there. But after 100 years, as they're hanging, you know, the force of gravity just allows these things to deteriorate. A couple of years ago, we were able to get through the Naval History and Heritage Command some money for conservation efforts. And I decided to put it right to the flags. The first priority was to preserve the War of 1812 flags, including the Royal British Royal Standard, which is the only one captured in combat. It was captured in York, Canada, then the capital. Then the British came down and destroyed our capital as a result. So we had to issue a contract to proper conservators. We had to hire a glass cutter, and it costs a lot of money to do just that. And then just to take these flags down. Now, we thought that there might be flags behind there from eight other conflicts. The expedition of 1871, which BJ will talk about, the 1854 expedition I'll talk about. But we weren't sure if they were still there. Our longtime 50-year historian had said, you know, there was a rumor that they were there. There was a photo, but we think they were moved and they've just been missing over the years. Best case scenario, these are simply deteriorated beyond all belief. Well, I actually was not there when they opened the first case. I had hoped to, but I had to do budget defense in D.C. for the museum's budget. About 15 minutes before I went into my meeting, I start getting some texts with photos from my deputy director saying, we opened the case, they're there. He starts sending the pictures from the expedition of 1871. And I'll tell you that for everybody who's listening to the show and you know how to justify budgets, it couldn't have been more fortuitous. I just put my cell phone down on the table, said, ladies and gentlemen, here's what your money's doing. And as a result, AP did a story. We had several new television stations come in. But I will say, the best thing about this, so many midshipmen stopping and watching this whole thing go on for a week at that point and later last week. So that's why we had them. That's why we did them.
Well, let's go a little more globally on this. Why do we have a Naval Academy Museum? Why do we have any Naval Heritage and History Command, and why do other countries celebrate their naval history? Let's talk a little bit about why this is important to us today to have these types of materials available to us.
Sure. Well, first of all, the Naval Academy Museum is the oldest Navy museum in the country. It's also one of the oldest academic museums. We had some sort of museum area since 1845. So there's been this tradition of ensuring that midshipmen, which is one of our missions, ensuring midshipmen understand their naval heritage. And we predate a lot of other Navy museums around the world as well. But we've had some start to come to us to talk about how do we put something together. So I've given a lot of tours to my counterparts and future counterparts around the world on, hey, here are the challenges that we've had. Here are the things that we like to display. Here's why we're doing it. And I'll turn it over to BJ now because he was there as a midshipman, but also now as an assistant professor.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Mark. And Claude kind of hits the nail on the head by starting with this idea of heritage. Because, you know, heritage has a specific meaning, right? Heritage versus history. There's a reason those two words are both in the command's name that's down at the Washington Navy Yard, history and heritage command. And because heritage is part of what we tell ourselves about our organization, how we self-identify as the U.S. Navy or as naval officers or as sailors. And heritage, the gateway to that heritage in many cases is artifacts, is the material history, as historians call it, the ability to see and sometimes even touch these things that come from our naval past can spark interest and can spark our desire to learn more. And in many ways, the heritage is that first step, right? What is the heritage of, let's say, the 1871 expedition to Korea? Well, the opening of Korea commercially is very important. There's a treaty that's signed several years later. We can see America rising in the world. These are all important themes that go to the heritage. And then hopefully that leads us to ask questions about the real history, right? And the history gets trickier and harder, and it makes us question whether that expedition in 1871 actually accomplished anything. And how effective were these people really in the things they did? And it helps us learn to ask hard questions about our service and our profession and how to go about trying to answer them in ways that are tricky because we have limited sources and we have difficult conflicting sources, and we're not quite sure always what to make of our past and how to analyze it. And so it becomes a skill that we have to learn how to do. It helps us think about hard problems and hard questions in the present once we've learned those skills in working with the past as well. And so this is all kind of wrapped up together in a larger question of how is it that naval professionals approach their service and their profession. And history and learning how to deal with history is a fundamental part of that, Tidge, and how we define ourselves as an organization is kind of the gateway to those questions.
And I'd like to add to BJ's point. Oh, sorry.
Good.
Part of that is understanding this particular century, and that's why I think BJ's work is so important, his dissertation and his other writing, because we tend to think today in terms of big navies, big wars, and that's our heritage, you know, the kings and the Nimitzes, etc. But we forget that most of our history is comprised of these expeditions and raids and operations that have extreme value in understanding the same kinds of operations we're conducting today.
BJ, I wanted to pull a thread on something because it reminded me of one of my great heartaches is when I ever hear a young man or woman say, oh, God, I hate history. It's so boring, because that just tells me they had bad instructions. It wasn't taught to them right. I've been blessed as a father, as my kids went to the same school that my wife and I did, which has always had an exceptional history department. We talk, as you might gather, it's a topic of conversation growing up with me. But talk a little bit, if you could, as somebody who gets young men and women in their late teens and early 20s sitting in a desk as you try to explain history. How do these types of discovery, these real-world objects, and especially for you, that's directly connected to the profession that these people have chosen, how does this help or shape how you can help get people excited and to dive an extra layer or two in history so they can better inform what they do now and in the future?
I think that artifacts like the ones that were discovered during this conservation effort that are a century old or older provide a way for a student to connect with that time and place that we forget is very hard to do, right? We forget it's very hard to picture ourselves and what the world was like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 200 years ago. When we teach contemporary history, right? When I teach my, American Naval History class, by the time we get to like the last 4 to 5 weeks of class and we're in World War II and later, and I have newsreel footage that I can show, and I have, photographs of specific moments in time in the history from battles in World War II, let's say, or from Vietnam. You can show those things and understanding begins to happen more quickly because the students can identify with what it was that they read in preparation for class that day. Right? Much of studying history is a textual activity. You have to read material. Many of our students today are not necessarily taught that, they should be textual learners. They're taught that they should be visual learners, or they're taught that they should be group learners. But textual learning is fundamental to history. It's also kind of fundamental to being a naval officer, because if you can't read your NATOPS or your TAC manuals, you're going to have a problem. But the idea that just working off that text is going to inspire them to be interested, let's be honest, that's not exactly accurate, right? And so how can you show that midshipman, in the case of the students I teach, but really any undergraduate student, how can you show them things that will help them identify with the things that they read, especially when you're talking about these pieces of the past that are from so long ago? So having the ability, as I did the one day when they were pulling these cases open, to just, have my class say, all right, we're not having class. My whole plan for this afternoon's done. Get up. We are walking over to Mahan Hall. We are going to go look at these things. We are going to talk about them. We're going to have the conservators help explain them to us. It was fantastic, right? You could see light bulbs coming on, eyes getting big, people interested in the material. I do similar things where I take the students over to the museum to see Claude's exhibits very early on in class to try and show them, like, look, there are these things that will help us understand what it is that we're reading, help us picture and imagine them. Studying history involves imagination. We have to admit that. And feeding that imagination is an important part of being a good teacher of history, I think.
As you guys uncovered these flags and recognized what you had, what lessons in archiving did you gather? I mean, you had some guy who's vague memory of, well, yeah, I think 50 years ago there somebody mentioned that there was flags. I mean, what goes on after that? Like, oh, maybe we should have kept better records, or now that we have them, how do we preserve them?
Our first assumption was that they didn't know really what they were doing 100 years ago, but as we were going into the letters, and keep in mind, we have about 150 years worth of letters on our exhibits and artifacts because we, over the years, it's required. And we found that they actually did due diligence. This Commander Cole, 100 years ago, was reaching out to every conservator and every museum that had a flag in the United States and Europe on how best to preserve these items. So there's really three things we're talking about. But the two primary ones I want to talk about are preservation and restoration, which are significantly different. We are currently preserving these flags because we had to take them down, again, because of gravity, and we're rolling them up. And there's been a concern that people will never see these again. And I wanted to allay folks' concerns because what we're doing, I've talked to the Academy about this, we are going to start displaying these in a very different way. We're going to be going to the rotunda of Bancroft Hall, which is where all the midshipmen live, once a semester with one of these flags and simply lay it out with hopefully some help from the history department, people like BJ, who can be there on site to show the midshipmen. And we're going to have an event on April 7th to display the British Royal Standard for the first time in almost 200 years. So the preservation almost is a little easier. We don't have people on staff who can do that. We have to actually hire out because we don't have enough people that are qualified in that particular. Think of it as a baseball team. We don't have the outfielders to do that particular function. The second part is restoration. We hope to restore these in the future, but that's a really expensive process, and I want to give you an example. The Star Spangled Banner is, I think, about 30 feet by 40 feet, and it's just a little bit larger than a lot of the flags that we had from the War of 1812, and including the British Royal Standard, which is 25 by 35. 20 years ago, when the United States government decided to restore this flag, the Star-Spangled Banner, it was an $18 million effort. The Navy doesn't have that kind of money. It's possible that we'll be able to find some money in the future to restore flags, but priority for us was preservation to ensure that these exist for future generations. So I think that was the biggest concern. And I think with most people and most programs, money is always a concern.
I think I'd just like to point out something here, because I remember this from when they first uncovered pulled the War of 1812 flags out of the cases after they had cut away the glass. And we were looking at the first two alcoves that they had opened up, and the particularly Spanish-American War battle flags and the Korean expedition flags that were in these two alcoves. And I was down there with Professor Miles Yu and Professor Lee Pennington, who from the history department are our China expert and our Japanese history expert. We were just kind of admiring what was there, and we were looking at one of Claude's team had with them copies of a pamphlet. I think pamphlet's probably the best way to describe it. Claude might correct me.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Of what was supposed to be in those alcoves, right? So back prior to World War One, when the original displays, not the War of 1812 flags that covered them, but the things that were rediscovered, were placed in those alcoves, a pamphlet was put together with photographs of how things looked inside those alcoves, and it was all kind of cataloged and printed to show how the Naval Academy had used those spaces in Mahan Hall. Because this is also, remember, before Preble Hall, which is the current home of the museum, was built. That was built by the Naval Institute in between World War One and World War Two, and so, you know, part of the museum displays were in Mahan Hall because of physical space. And so that catalog pamphlet existed, and as they pulled those flags out, what they found behind them was almost exactly what that catalog said, what that pamphlet said would be there. It's just that, you know, after over 100 years, no one thought that pamphlet was still accurate. We all figured things had changed. And then in the serendipity of history, and this is one of the things I love about doing archival history work, is you make these little discoveries all the time. When you flip to the cover page of that pamphlet, the name on the front of it, the guy who did the work, was Commander Ernest J. King, who would later go on, right, to be the CNO during World War II and be a massive figure in our American naval history. But prior to World War I, he did a tour at the Naval Academy as an instructor, and he helped work with the museum, and he's the guy that wrote that pamphlet.
It's amazing how some of the names. Claude, let's want to roll over to you, because except for those people that have watched the sequels to the Pirates of the Caribbean movie, a lot of them probably never associated Westpac and China with piracy. But I believe the oldest flag that was discovered during renovation work dates back pre-U.S. Civil War to Macau pirates. Talk for a little bit, if you could, about piracy in the Westpac in that time period, and also the flag and how we came about to get it.
Sure. I think we forget that we've been trading with China for a really long time. The first ship to trade with China came out of New York in 1784. We have New England merchants, especially in the 1830s, earning money there, not only with spice trade, but opium. And when the Taiping Rebellion happens in the 1850s, you have a lot of civil unrest. It's a major civil war. One of the U.S. Navy officers writes home to his wife that he had heard rumors of 30,000 people being beheaded in Canton alone. So when Commodore Matthew Perry has his squadron in Japan, he decides to dispatch one of his ships, the Macedonian, under Captain Joel Abbott, to protect U.S. interests, because we had a lot of merchants in Hong Kong and some in Macau. So what he does is something kind of interesting. It's lost to history. Not only does he send the Macedonian, but he charters a local commercial steamer, the Queen. It's 137 tons, and he places in command a lieutenant, Lieutenant George Henry Preble. He's the nephew of Commodore Edward Preble, who fights the Barbary pirates. As commerce is being threatened, Preble is using his ship to go inshore. He has several encounters with Chinese pirates. At one point, he takes on 10 Chinese pirate junks at one time before the howitzer carriage breaks, and he has to pull away, and he enlists some help from the local international community. And I think this is an important story too, because we're a young Navy operating in pirate-infested waters to protect our commerce. And it's not just us. It's mostly the British who are there, but they build a coalition of the British, Portuguese, who controlled Macau at the time, the British controlled Hong Kong, and there were 13 different countries represented in Canton. The United States role is a very small part, but it's a very important part because they're the ones who have the steamer. Another British one comes along. So you have essentially four countries. Some Chinese military are involved as well to attack the pirates off of Macau. Mostly they are based at a small island about 20 nautical miles southeast of Macau. And in a series of four actions, Preble is able to get small boats from the Macedonian, small boats from one of the British ships. He starts towing them closer and closer. He's able to give covering fire against the Chinese junks and eventually to some of the Chinese fortresses. They go ashore, and some 350 troops from the international community are attacking the pirates. They burn the village. They burn about 50 Chinese pirate junks. They take three Chinese pirate fortresses. And this isn't the only pirate action that Preble's involved with. Because of his success, he's later given command the following year to another steamer, the Confucius, to do some operations in Shanghai. So I think what's really important, number one, is that Preble, as a lieutenant, is having essentially operational command from the United States standpoint, that he's entrusted with it, and that he's able to conduct these operations with the international community. Now, he and his men capture about 10 trophy flags. We don't know what happened to most of them, but at least one of them came to the United States Naval Academy Museum, and that's the one that, if you go to the Midrats page, you'll see it's an octagon. It's a red Chinese pirate flag, and that's the one that really struck me because there were so many of these lessons about working with the international community. And Preble himself had been offered the XO position of the North Seas Exploring and Survey Expedition, and he turned it down. And instead, that's why he gains command, and he loved it. It was his first command, and I think that's also a lesson, is that, you know, you may see these opportunities for within the Navy, but then there's this small ship that nobody's ever heard of, nobody's ever used before, and that's extremely important, too, for individual officers to know that there are opportunities everywhere.
That's a great story. Talk a little bit about... I guess then also if you're studying the Yangtze River Patrol later on and you can trace that history of involvement with China, I guess back to these early dates of dealing with the pirates plus the international trade that went into Canton and the opium wars. I'm sure there's a question there somewhere, but I just suddenly the light went on and I made the connection. Talk a little bit about our involvement with Korea in 1871.
So in 1871, the United States Navy heads for Korea in part as a response to another event that happened in Korea in 1866, in part as a diplomatic mission in part in a search for the kind of glory that Matthew Perry earned for himself after the opening of Japan. And so there's a number of competing motives here. But Korea in the 1860s and early 1870s was known as the Hermit Kingdom then, too. It's a nickname that still sticks around for North Korea today in many ways. But it was known as the Hermit Kingdom then because they had maintained their isolation, much in the way that Japan had, you know, prior to the arrival of Perry and his black ships, as the Japanese called them. And so Korea had maintained this separation from the rest of the world in a very insular nature. They had always rebuffed efforts to open trade, not just to the West, but also largely within Asia itself. They had a relationship with China, with the Qing Dynasty of China. As a part of the region, they showed some fealty towards the court in Peking, but they were very much an isolated nation. And in 1866, an American ship named the General Sherman, now this was a civilian ship, it was owned by an American, it was captained by an American, had this polyglot crew of Chinese sailors and Malays, and there was one alleged British crew, there was a missionary, and this sounds like some kind of Indiana Jones movie at this point, but this is what the makeup of the General Sherman's crew was. And they had stocked trade goods in China from the British and had headed for Korea to open Korean trade on their own. They were going to do this for the United States and for the world out of the goodness of their heart. No, not really, out of their profit motive, right? And so they sailed up the Taedong River, attempting to get near Pyongyang, and they ended up running aground. And what happens to the General Sherman, we're not really sure. From the documentary record, the only thing we really have to go off of is a report that the Koreans give the Americans several years later. What the Korean government tells the American government is the ship came up, they started handing out Bibles, they started causing trouble. When we told them to go away, they refused to go away. They started trying to trade with Korean merchants, we told them to stop, they refused. And then when we sent a messenger with an official with some bodyguards, they kidnapped him and held him hostage to try and get us to sign a trade treaty. At which point the local governor, you know, ordered his militia out, and they attacked the ship, and they killed everybody on board. And that's the report that comes back to the Americans. And so in the late 1860s, the United States Navy and the State Department kind of want to figure out what happened. But on the other hand, they kind of know what the crew of the ship was like, right? They know that this was not an official party, certainly not the kind of people they wanted representing the United States government. And so they also weren't going to push too hard. So after several U.S. Navy visits to Korea that are rebuffed by the Koreans, they're told, hey, thanks for coming. We appreciate your interest in the General Sherman. Here's our report. Now go away. The Americans, you know, they did. They followed the instructions of the Korean government. They left. Eventually, Rear Admiral John Rogers, who is the son of the famous War of 1812 commander, still in the Navy at this point, he's in his 60s as a rear admiral, he's on deployment, he's in command of the Asiatic Squadron based in Japan, and he decides he's going to claim the same glory that Perry had. And he sails his squadron from Nagasaki to Korea to try and negotiate a treaty. He takes with him the American consul or ambassador to the court at Peking, a guy named Frederick Lowe, a State Department diplomat. And they sail for Korea. And they end up reaching there. They reach the estuary around what we know today as modern Incheon. In May, they sail in May. They arrive in early June of 1871. And they proceed to try and negotiate a treaty. Now, the Koreans don't want to negotiate a treaty. They want to remain the Hermit Kingdom. So there's a lot of miscommunication, let's put it that way, between the diplomats involved here. And it doesn't help that in some ways that the Americans follow the model that Perry had given them from two decades before, and that is Perry refused to negotiate with anybody except for a duly appointed representative of the emperor or the king. And so local officials would just be rebuffed when they tried to answer questions. And Frederick Low follows that same negotiating tactic. So it clearly doesn't make the Koreans happy. And then John Rogers also follows from Perry's playbook, and he puts his surveying boats in the water to begin surveying the rivers and the harbors around Incheon, the Sali River, the Han River, all around Gungawa Island. And so it's in this process of surveying, which American naval officers consider an effort towards civilization, right? It's not just naval power. It's not just American diplomacy that makes the world safe for American and Western merchants. It's science as well. And they are going to dispatch science in the effort towards expanding American global trade. So they're surveying. So they're mapping out the approaches to the harbor. And the problem with this is the Koreans obviously see this as an infringement on their sovereignty, right? This is intelligence collection. These boats are heading up rivers and into Korean territory, measuring things, taking down reports. And so eventually, as the boats near the north end of Gungawa Island, the local militia leader orders his fortress to open fire on the Americans. And so he drives off the boats. Two gunboats, the USS Monocacy and Palos, kind of come up the river and begin returning fire on the fort. They silence the guns of the fort, and everyone kind of withdraws. And at this point, you know, the Americans are left with a choice. What do we do about this? We were just fired upon. And Admiral Rogers and Frederick Low decide that the Koreans need to be punished for this obvious dishonor to the American flag, which was just there in the name of science. Or so the Americans would claim. And so the Americans make an ultimatum. Frederick Low contacts the local officials and says, if you don't agree to open negotiations with us and apologize for firing on our boats within the next 10 days, then we will land and attack you. And of course, the Koreans don't want anything to do with this. So they simply reinforce their garrisons that they reinforce with local militia, and the Americans wait for the Koreans to say they're sorry. The Koreans won't say they're sorry, and eventually the timeline runs out, and the Americans launch an amphibious assault on Gungawa Island. And there's about a three-day-long evolution on the island. The Americans attack the three forts in sequence. Tactically, the Americans are pretty much incredibly dominant. The Korean militia is poorly trained. It's poorly armed. The Americans bring their own artillery ashore. They've got the heavy guns of the squadron to help them. They've got 500 sailors and Marines that land as their assault force, with many of them being combat veterans from the American Civil War. So the Americans win pretty handily in these battles. But it doesn't get anybody anywhere. And so after several days of waiting to try and reopen negotiations and the Koreans continuing to refuse to talk, the Americans have run out of ammunition. They're running out of supplies. They've put holes in two of their boats because they ran them aground during the fighting. And they weigh anchor and they just leave, having accomplished almost nothing despite the tactical success on the island. So that's the basic story of what happens in the summer of 1871 around what we know of today's Incheon.
Claude, the Korean campaign and the flags discovered, and we talked a little bit early on in the show about how that sparked some interest at the Naval Academy and here in the U.S. about our history. What type of reaction have you received from the Korean side of the house?
Well, we've actually met a couple of times. We have a Korean officer who serves at the Naval Academy, as we do. We have a British officer. We have an Italian, Mexican. We have a French officer. They mostly teach in seamanship and navigation and some in languages. But they obviously have a renewed interest in their history, justifiably so, because they have a series of museums. They plan on building a naval museum in the Republic of Korea as well. We did loan about 10 years ago what's called the Generalissimo. It's the general's flag from the Korean expedition of 1871 that was captured. And in that case, we were unable to display it and at that time. So we loaned it out to South Korea, where they are able to display it in a wonderful fashion. You know, I did mention that I have spoken with the British as well, because we're going to have this event on April 7th, and we're going to try to live stream it. At the very least, we'll have it a video of it and put it on YouTube, the Naval Academy Museum's YouTube channel, and on our Facebook page. But we're bringing in the Canadians and the British together to really talk about our collective heritage. You know, the British Royal Standard is caused a friendship forged by fire, if you will. This flag that had flown over Parliament House during the War of 1812 and is captured by Zebulon Pike and brought over back to the United States by Isaac Chauncey and his crew within the United States Navy. Very significant. And I think they're wonderful talking points and recognition points when we're working with our international partners to show that we've had these wars in the past, but for 200 years, we have had one of the strongest partnerships with these two countries. And now since the Korean War, we've had this wonderful relationship with South Koreans. I know in my reserve status, I've done three exercises which involved South Koreans, and just incredible individuals to work with. And I'm now working with the French as well, and I'm going to be taking a trip to England next month to defend my dissertation, but also meeting with my counterparts in England to talk about how we can best present our history, things we need to do to change how we've been doing things. Because one of the things I hoped to do when I took over the museum 6 years ago was to make it to really take down the walls of the museum and make it more accessible to the general public, and to make it more applicable to the students. You know, we've mentioned before, I've worked with chemistry majors, physics majors on a variety of projects to show that STEM majors can have a significant impact on understanding our naval heritage as well. And they've really responded extremely well to that. And as BJ said, if you can foster that imagination with the midshipmen, you know, these midshipmen are just absolutely incredible. You know, you kind of wind them up and let them go, and you'd be surprised what they can do. And so when BJ and I have opportunities like this to work with them, to work with the languages department where we wouldn't normally do something, it's a wonderful opportunity to really foster those things in our mids and the general public.
Yeah, I was thinking about the flags of the War of 1812, I don't know if the history department uses Ian Toll's six frigates as a re-material, and then having the flags there from some of those battles. I would imagine that would be a fairly effective way of helping to teach that particular part of our history. Is that part of what goes on there?
Yeah. So one of the great things about the United States Naval Academy and the way it's set up academically is we have modeled ourselves almost more academically, more on an average or above average, I guess we should say, liberal arts school or university in our education system, as opposed to a military training organization. And what I mean by that is within the history department, we teach the American Naval History class almost entirely to plebes. Occasionally there's an upperclassman who misses it and has to take it, you know, later on, but mostly to plebes, mostly in their first year at the academy. But each instructor is allowed to design their own syllabus within certain guidelines, right? And we all kind of work together to make sure that we're all working within those guidelines. But academic freedom is a real thing at the Naval Academy, and it gives professors the ability to try new pedagogy, to try new methods of teaching, to try different written assignments that may or may not work for some students or others. And so many, many professors try many different things. And so, yes, there are some who take their student, like I told you about. I take my students over to the museum itself. I've walked them over to Mahan Hall. There are other instructors that do that as well. But the great joy, I think, in the way the history department works at the Naval Academy today is that we're not handcuffed by a entirely programmed curriculum for us, right? They don't hand you the binder and say, here's what you teach, do this. we all help each other. Granted, we help each other build our syllabi to make the most effective courses, but it allows us also to experiment and to try with different teaching methods that I think is, it's absolutely fantastic. So it's a long way around your answer is, the answer to your question is, yes, there are professors that do that, but not every professor does it every semester because we're constantly trying new things to get our students to connect with the material.
I kind of like to have both of y'all address this question because I know a lot of times when you're trying to get history, you just, lack of a better phrase, you hit the wave tops. You just hit the bold-faced items. And, you know, there's World War I, World War II, there's the Spanish-American War, there's the Civil War in 1812, Revolutionary War. And the Korean expedition is in that period of time. If you look at it, the period of time from 1871 to what many consider America's global coming out party, the Spanish-American War, that's about the same period of time as the end of the Cold War to today. And there was just an incredible change in America, not just in its place in the world, but its size, but in technology. But besides the Korean expedition, and maybe we can start with Claude talking about what people, when they're rushing to go look at the World War II exhibits, you know, what are some things from that period at the Naval Academy Museum are the things that you think are most important in that period leading up to the Spanish-American War that many times is overlooked?
You know, I think I've this. I hope this doesn't sound like a cop out, but I would say that expedition of 1871, and as I look back on what we have, particularly after the Civil War, we have a few things from, say, the Jeannette expedition, but only a couple of items from the Korean expedition. So I think in the future we may try to expand that portion. But I think we forget that the amount of exploration that the United States Navy did in the 19th century. We've got a little bit on Charles Wilkes and the exploring expedition, that four-year expedition with six ships. But I'd like to do more of a focus on some of the smaller operations we have. BJ, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think this is an era from the close of the Civil War, you know, up through the Spanish-American War that tends to have a particular narrative placed on top of it by historians, and that it's kind of the Mahanian view. You know, to give it a caricaturized name, we look at that era, and you know, Craig Simons and other historians have called it the doldrums of the Navy, this era after the Civil War. Oh, there was retrenchment. Oh, you know, the Navy fell back into old, small-minded ways, you know, or its technology fell behind. And these are the things that are focused on that then lead to the development of the Naval War College, the creation of the Naval Institute, the rebirth of naval professionalism in the lead-up to the Spanish-American War, the eventual introduction of the new Navy, the Steel Navy. And we focus on that kind of professional development, and we focus on that technological development in terms of the creation of the new Steel Navy. And in doing so, many times I think we look away from the operational record of that era. Now, it's easier for us to do in the late 20th and early 21st centuries to look back and say, well, there were no wars then. There couldn't have been anything important that happened. Right? That Mahanian view, that caricature of Mahan that says only big fleet battles matter, and that's what the Navy has brought on board from reading Mahan's stuff, even though that's not entirely what the guy says, makes us look back on the past and say, well, only the big wars, we should focus on those when we study our history. But when we look at that era, from the end of the Civil War up through the Spanish-American War, the Korean expedition isn't by itself. We have the Korean expedition, we have the events at Samoa where the Royal Navy and the Imperial German Navy and the U.S. Navy almost start a war at Samoa, and they're only stopped by the hurricane that hits Apia and sinks them all. So there's the events at Samoa, there's the rebellion in Hawaii and the deposing of Queen Liliuokalani. There's a number of these events that happen during this era. The Navy is busy during this era. So calling it the doldrums, it may be a doldrums in terms of naval professionalism, because there's not much change until the second half of the period. It may be the doldrums in terms of the introduction of new technology. But in terms of operations, the Navy is busy. It returns to the squadron stations after the Civil War, and it goes into operational mode. And sailors are operating, they're doing things, they're protecting American interests, they're protecting American trade. You know, the Navy goes into the Civil War with 42 ships in commission. It grows to almost 600 ships during the Civil War. And then after the Civil War and the drawdown, it comes back down to 52 ships in commission. So if we remove that 600 number for the wartime, we can see that the Navy grew by almost 20% coming out of the Civil War from what it was before the war. It was bigger. It was more modern. And those ships went and they sailed around the world and they did things. Very few historians have studied that operational record and the diplomatic record that goes along with it. And I think there's much for us to learn there, because as you pointed out, it's a period that ends in a significant moment with the end of the Spanish-American War, and in many ways, America stepping onto the world stage as a great power. But the behaviors of a great power were shaped in the century before that moment, and we need to understand that as well.
You know, that's a great point that BJ makes, and I want to go even further back into the 19th century and why there are so many historians who look at the War of 1812 and they bookend it with Civil War, and they forget everything in between, you know, the development of steam technology, and why I looked at this for my doctoral dissertation, why BJ looked at that period for his doctoral dissertation, and mine, I'm looking at operations primarily during Jackson's administration. You know, the 1820s, 1830s, when we're developing overseas squadrons for the first time, we hadn't done that on permanent stations prior to the War of 1812, prior to 1816-17. So there's a really rich naval history that we have, and you know, I think folks tend to rely heavily on the big wars and rather than the operations and what that enabled us to do, especially in protecting commerce either against pirates or to deflect certain situations around the world.
And I don't want you to think that I'm suggesting that historians haven't studied this stuff, right? Some have. I mean, there's some really good books out there, like John Schroeder's Shaping American Empire, or Shaping Maritime Empire, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really excellent in that pre-Civil War era. Ken Hagen's American Gunboat Diplomacy in the Old Navy, about kind of a section of that post-Civil War era, about, you know, it's about a He covers about a decade, a little bit more than a decade of that period. So there are historians who have looked at this material and have written about it, have written excellent books on it. But we have this narrative in American history that the United States of the 19th century was an isolationist nation. And that's when you start looking at the naval history and the diplomatic history, that's just fundamentally untrue. The United States is busy in the world for much of the 19th century. What it's doing and why, what its motivations are, those things shift over time, and understanding those would probably be really beneficial to us today when we are asking questions about what is the place of the United States in the world? What is the American role in the world?
Alternatively, what is the role of other countries as they start to establish squadrons and establish trade routes, et cetera?
Eagle One, over to you.
I'm surprised somebody didn't mention the first U.S. military intervention in Asia, which some people say happened in 1832 with the Jacksonian Navy taking on pirates, the Malay pirates or the Sumatran pirates.
Sumatra.
It was Sumatra. It was the frigate Potomac in 1832. I have a hard time labeling that as the first in Asia, although it might be the first combat operation, I guess we could say, in Asia. It's an operation that I've studied pretty extensively, and I've published on it in a couple places. But it's one of these moments, right, that is the kind of thing that Claude and I are talking about. There's this operation that happens in 1832. There's another one that happens in almost the same place for very similar reasons in 1838. the operations are conducted completely differently. The motivations and the ideas that the commanders have involved in those, if you read their correspondence, are different. Why are they different? How did these people come to different conclusions? And in the end, villages are burned in both cases. So they both result in the loss of innocent life in another part of the world. So it's really interesting to look at these cases and compare them to each other and think about the kinds of questions that might help inform us today.
Claude, that's kind of your period of time. Do you have any thoughts on the topic?
No, you know, I tell you, I would actually recommend to listeners to I think we've covered this a couple of times in Midrats, especially about Jackson's Navy, and certainly we've done the late 19th century with the Warrior Writers podcast that you did with me and Craig Simons. So I'd recommend those. But
oh,
I would
point.
Say, you know, I know we're getting short on time, but I just want to circle back to something about Preble and the Star Spangled Banner, because Preble, after the 1854 attacks with the pirates, goes on to serve in the Union Navy and is released from active duty because he's seen as having failed to capture the CSS Florida. But it's his post-Civil War work that I think is significant in this hour that we're discussing. Because he writes a history of U.S. flags, writes a book. He writes several books, including a diary of his actions and his time during that 1853-55 period. But I don't know how he got it, but he came to own or have the Star-Spangled Banner. And in 1873, it's Preble who recognizes the significance of this flag and orders a sailcloth to be sewn to it in order to better preserve it. So he's the first person to do that, but also to photograph the Star Spangled Banner. And it's because of him that continues on for further restoration work. And how does that tie to our story? Because Amelia Fowler and her 40 seamstresses spend almost a year at the Naval Academy sewing these flags in her particular style to ensure that they are preserved. Because of her work at the Naval Academy, she goes on to get the contract to preserve the Star-Spangled Banner. And I think she later did the ones at the Mass State House as well. But that's how this whole thing ties in. BJ talked about Commander King. We've talked about Lieutenant Preble and now Admiral Preble. But that's how these all tie in together.
Perfect. And gentlemen, that was a very fast hour. It's great having both of you on, because even when we have you on solo, it's a fast hour, doubly so with both of you here. And I hope this sparks in the listeners an interest to go. Just Google what's going on with the flags, and maybe to look into this period of time in the 1800s that, as BJ and Claude, you yourself outlined, doesn't get as much attention as you want to, but it's not the doldrums. It's not boring. We weren't isolationist. There's very much a lot of the missions they were doing then we continue to do the next century and right now. And as we tie things up, and BJ, let's start with you, and then we'll have Claude tied up. What are you working on right now? And if the listeners wanted to make sure to keep track of what you find interesting and what you might be putting out there for folks to read, how's best for them to keep an eye on you?
Well, what I'm working on right now is grading. So it's another part of being a professor. But I recently finished up some rewriting on a book that I've completed based on some of my doctoral research that we hope will be released next year with the University of Oklahoma Press, entitled Small Boats and Daring Men, all about naval irregular warfare and the age of sail. And so I recently finished that up, and I also recently gave a talk at the museum for Claude about the 1871 expedition. So if anyone's interested in more, you can find that on the Naval Academy Museum's YouTube page. I go into some more detail. And one of the one of the very interesting things about that expedition is it's one of the very first overseas expeditions that has a photographer along. And so in that talk, in that lecture that I gave at the museum, I brought along on the PowerPoint slides a lot of the original imagery of the events themselves, the ships, the men, operations ashore, to illustrate the history. And I think that was I think it was pretty effective. I actually find those photographs to be pretty stunning. So you can find that lecture on the Naval Academy YouTube page.
And I'm defending my dissertation next month, and I'm working with a publisher, and I hope to have the book about Andrew Jackson's Navy out in about a year or so, depending on my schedule, because I'm being mobilized. I've got orders to go over to be out of the country for a year. So I don't know how that much is going to delay my work. And so I probably won't be writing or publishing much while I'm away.
Well, we'll keep an eye on you anyway, Claude. And again, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us today. It's a pleasure. I look forward to the next opportunity.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next week, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Hello!